Now we're going. Okay, so here in 2 Timothy chapter 4, we were talking, started in verse 6, I forgot to turn this on, but he was talking about being poured out in the time of his departure. We're talking about him living the Christian life. That's what he means by I've agonized the good agony. He uses this word agony for the contest or the activity of living the Christian life, looking at it as an athletic activity. And I have finished the course, so he's looking at it as though life is a race, and I have kept the faith, which isn't guarding, as we've been talking about. We've kind of been pointing this out on, well, for a while now. It's not just guarding all Christian doctrine. It's looking specifically at really focusing on the promises that God has made to us as New Testament believers. That's what the faith is. And he says, I've kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me then a crown of righteousness. Why would he call it a crown of righteousness? What's the why is that the description of the crown? Why would you say? In light of what he just said, agonized the good agony, finished or completed the course, and have kept the faith. What do all those things end up having in common? They're doing what's right. That's righteous. They all involve righteous activity. Exactly. They involve righteous activity of a believer. So he says, there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness. Paul, in living out the Christian life in those three different capacities, as he pictures it, all involves righteous activity. And none of that righteous activity is possible outside of our position in Christ, as we kind of looked at that on Sunday when we just blitzed through the armor of God at the end. We'll look at it in more detail eventually. And the Lord will give to me in that day, who is the righteous judge, and not only to me, but to all those who have loved his appearing. If you go on down in the context down here, he says in verse 16, he says, the Lord stood with me in my first, defense. No one then was present with me. All abandoned me. Don't let it be counted against them. In other words, other people were kind of frightened off, perhaps, by what happened, but they all ran off. But the Lord stood present to me. And he strengthened me, and that would be, again, mental strength, mental fortitude, in order that the proclamation might be through me fully carried out, so that the Gentiles might hear. And I was rescued from the mouth of the lion. So the first time he stood before Caesar, that's the event that ends Acts 28. He's in Acts 28. Under house arrest, waiting to stand before Caesar. That's that event. And on that time, he's saved from the mouth of the lions. He isn't cast to the lions. So he survives that imprisonment. But then he says, and the Lord will rescue me from every evil work. Now that's this time. This time he's already said back in verse 6, I'm being poured out, and the time of my departure is present. It's at the door. So this time he knows he's going to die. The first time, he didn't die. But on this occasion, Paul knows he's going to die. They've passed a death sentence. Because he's a Roman citizen, he has this window of time in which he's allowed to put affairs in order and take care of things like that. And this is where he's at in that window between the sentence being given and being carried out. If he were not a Roman citizen, if he would have been Peter, they'd take him off and they'd be over with. Okay. But Paul is a different situation. He's a Roman citizen. So he says, verse 18, the Lord will rescue me from every evil work. Good way to look at death. Death is, from Paul's perspective, he doesn't look at death and go, oh, I don't want to die. He says, no, it's being rescued from every, I'm not going to have to face anything. Well, the worst thing that they think they can do to me is actually a great thing for me. It's going to remove me from this mess. One second, death. Next second, he's in the third heaven, enjoying paradise, or the third heaven, we should say. He says, and he will save me into, not the kingdom of the heavens like we have in Matthew, but into his heavenly kingdom. Which, by the way, tells you that when you die, you don't, unlike Seventh-day Adventists, you don't go into a state of sleep where you're just nothing. There was the statement Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, where he says, absent from the body, present with the Lord. Seventh-day Adventists say, well, that's because you die, and it's just like taking a nap. You lay down, you open your eyes, and the next minute, and you're awake, but years have passed by, potentially. Or they, for you, sleeping, you know, an hour may have passed by, napping, and you don't know an hour passed by. Okay? That's the way they do it. But Paul says, no. He dies, It's going into the heavenly kingdom. Kingdom indicates activity, things going on. Okay. So he says he's going to rescue me into his heavenly kingdom, to whom is glory, or really this reputation into the ages of the ages. So we're looking at the end of this letter because it's telling us that this is Paul's final letter, and this is the letter in which he is going to die sometime after he's done writing this. And Paul's okay with that. In fact, when Paul wrote Philippians during his first imprisonment, he's expecting his trial to go well. He's expecting to be released when he writes Philippians, but he says in there, if I had my way, if I had my druthers, I'd die. I'd be out of here, guys. But I'm going to stick around for your kid. And I don't know exactly what he meant by what I'm going to choose. You know, he maybe gone in and tried to submarine his own trial, his own defense, and get himself into trouble. I don't know exactly what he meant by that. But that time he says, no, I'm going to stick around for your sake. But it wasn't what he really wanted. What he wanted was to die and go to be with the Lord. Now, the reason we do all this is because when the book of Acts ends, Paul's in prison. Now he's in prison again, and some people say there's just one imprisonment. But I want to look at a couple things right here in 2 Timothy that indicate that there's a space of time between these two imprisonments, that there's some things that have gone on. And so if you look, let's go back to 1 Timothy chapter 1 before we look here in 2 Timothy. Look back in 1 Timothy 1. Look with me at verse 3. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 3, he says, even as I encouraged you to remain in Ephesus while, talking about himself, while going into Macedonia. So here's a time that you do not have recorded in the book of Acts. This is not in Luke's account of anything like this, where Paul actually goes to Ephesus and then heads north into Macedonia. Ephesus is on the east side of the Aegean Sea in what we would know as modern-day Turkey. Macedonia is north of Greece. It's on the west side of the Aegean Sea. It stretches across what we would know as the Grecian Peninsula from the Aegean Sea over to the Adriatic, and all across that. So if you think of the Grecian Peninsula, Macedonia is this northern part up here. Think of, what was it back in the 90s? Croatia, Bosnia, all those things that were in the news a lot. That was in that area. Okay, that's where Macedonia was. So here's a time where Paul had actually gone back to Ephesus after the book of Acts and leaves Timothy behind. Flip over to Titus. In Titus, in verse 5, we have Titus 1 and verse 5. He's talking about some things at the first part, which we've already dealt with, and he says, for this reason or this cause, I left you then in Crete. Now, when do you ever have Paul visiting the island of Crete? You don't have that in Acts. You have him visiting the island of Cyprus, but you never have Paul visiting the island of Crete in Acts. So this is a after Acts 28 visit. That's never recorded by Luke, because Luke ends with Paul in prison, Acts 28, in Rome. So this is another event. Flip now back to 2 Timothy. Look to chapter 4 where we were. 2 Timothy chapter 4. And he says in verse 10, for Demas has abandoned me, having loved the present age. Maybe we'll talk about that eventually on Sunday mornings for sure when we talk about the world, but maybe we'll hit it in here. And it says, and went to Thessalonica. Crescens took off for Galatia. It doesn't say that there was anything bad about that. Titus has gone to Dalmatia. Now, that's important because that shows you that Paul had left Titus. We know when Paul writes Corinthians, and in 2 Corinthians, Paul says he had either left or sent Titus down to Corinth to take care of some things down there. And now Titus had come back to him. But after that, from the book of Titus, Titus has gone to Crete. Now here at the end of Paul's life, Titus isn't on Crete anymore. Titus has apparently come to where Paul was, and he's gone to Dalmatia. Dalmatia is on the east side of the Adriatic Sea, if you were to look at a map. And it's, in other words, from your point of view, we have the Grecian peninsula. Greece is kind of down across the south. Athens and Corinth over here. Dalmatia's over on this side. And here's Italy, Adriatic Sea and Italy over here. If you look at it on a map, the problem is in most of your maps of the Bible, my maps don't have Dalmatia listed. But if you look in there, you see Macedonia, and on the west coast of it, where it's against the Adriatic, that's where Dalmatia would be, in that area, Macedonia, or just to the north of it.
So on the side where the water separating it from Italy?
Yes. Yeah, so you can see Illyricum. And, under there, I do see it now. I didn't see this earlier. It does say Dalmatia. You just got to look out through the very bottom of my glasses to make it out. It's so small. Okay. So you can see Illyricum also includes part of Dalmatia, okay, underneath there.
So and Illyricum wasn't a city, it was an area?
Yes, it's a region. Yeah, Dalmatia is an area. So anyway, so that's Titus. So that's showing you that Titus has moved on to some other places, okay? Is everybody still trying to find Dalmatia on your maps? Okay.
So mine says Illyrica and then Dalmatian in parentheses under it.
Under it, yeah, that's the way mine had. And see, it was such small print, I couldn't make it out. Looking out the top of my glasses, I'd look out the bottom. Does everybody kind of find that, if they want it? Okay. Now, back to 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4, he says in here, now, when we read 1 Timothy, Paul has left Timothy in Ephesus. But here in 2 Timothy, he says, now Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. Now, probably meaning that he's sending him there to take over for Timothy, to cover for Timothy, because he wants Timothy to come to him, maybe before he's going to be killed, or maybe to bring some of his items with him so that they can be, shall we say, bequeathed to other people, distributed among them as his, because he doesn't have a lot of possessions. It's not like, that 40 acres I've got. No, it's like that. His property are scrolls and a cloak and things like that. That's his property, and he's going to distribute those. So he says in verse 12 of 2 Timothy 4, Tychicus I sent to Ephesus, and the cloak that I left here, verse 13, the cloak which I left behind in Troas with Carpus. So there was another trip in which Paul had traveled through Troas. Now, Troas, he probably went through Troas on his way from Ephesus up to Macedonia, because Troas was along the way, if you look at that in a map. It's up in the northeast corner of the Aegean Sea there, with Carpus. If you look down in verse 20, he says, Erastus remained in Corinth. So, on some time, when Paul has made another visit through Corinth, Erastus, who was apparently traveling with him, he's left him behind. Trophimus, I left behind in Miletus. Miletus, if you remember, is a coastal town west of Ephesus. Now, why am I going through all these things? Why am I showing you these? Because we're trying to demonstrate that some time has passed. There's enough time for Paul to have between the time of Acts 28 for Paul to have traveled back to Crete and left Titus there, for Paul to have traveled up to Turkey and to have left Timothy there, for Paul to have gone up and visited Macedonia, Paul apparently to have returned down and visited Corinth. So in other words, he's kind of, whether we don't know the exact direction, but some people propose that he left from Rome and sailed south and went down to Crete and then started up Miletus, Ephesus, Troas, Macedonia, down the east coast and down to Corinth and such. And then apparently back to Rome, where he's arrested again. And that's kind of the way church history has it. There's also the possibility from what he writes, when he writes the Romans, that, and some people have said that he did this, because church history tells, but we don't know what he gives no indication in Scripture that he did, that in between his two imprisonments, he also took a trip from Rome west to Spain, which when he writes Rome, when he writes the book of Romans, that's what he was intending to do, is to stop in Rome when he was free, not imprisoned at that time, and to spend some time with them and then have them supply him and send him on his way so that he can continue a journey to Spain. Whether or not he did that, we don't have any scriptural proof. We only have church history. But time has passed. And we can do a lot of this. I just gave you a real brief demonstration here towards the end of Paul's life of some of the places that he was between these two imprisonments. And the reason for that is, how long does it take you to do that? Well, for you today, you could hop on a cruise ship or an airplane or get in a car, and you could make a lot of those trips zip, zip, zip with some speed. Paul's doing most of this on foot, some of it on a sailboat. Okay, and so this takes a little while for Paul to do. And it's these kind of things that historians use as they go through. And then we have in the book of Acts that it tells us Paul spends 2 years here and he spends 18 months here. And we actually have some time references where it actually shows you precisely how long he stayed in some places. He's in Thessalonica. He's there for 3 Sabbaths. Is he there longer than that? Well, sure, maybe he is there longer. But 3 Sabbaths kind of tells you he wasn't there very long. And as we looked at on Sunday, Paul was concerned that there were some things that were left undone. In other words, Paul felt his time at Thessalonica was cut short, and he didn't get to do everything there that he felt he needed to do. And so Paul spent time. All of that then comes down to this to help us understand that historians probably fairly well date Paul's death or the writing of 2 Timothy about 67 or 68 AD. That is about 17 or 18 years after Acts 15. That's fairly important because in Acts 15, Paul has a really good, well-developed understanding of what it means to live by grace, because that's the whole issue in Acts 15, is living by grace. When you come to 2 Timothy now, 17 or 18 years later, and he's writing to Timothy, if you don't understand that Paul, 17 or 18 years earlier, had a good understanding of what it meant to live by grace, I don't think that that's probably changed over the 17 or 18 years, except that it has even gotten more refined, clearer, that his stance on what it means to live by grace has become even stronger. And if there's any of you in here that remember back to the time that you first got a little glimpse of what it meant to live by grace and not live by law, and then you compare yourself from whenever that was to the present time, I hope all of you can say that understanding has only gotten better, both in terms of knowledge as well as in experiential knowledge as you're living it out. And that's, and I think that that's very important. Because two of the issues in this letter, two of these issues, are actually going to be people in that Timothy's going to be having to deal with that are causing problems with regard to this very issue of doctrine. We're going to, I'm going to point out the second two issues. You can look ahead and read on these, but the second two issues I think that really come up, if you look in chapter 2, we're going to look at the first issue tonight mostly, but the second two issues, no, 2 Timothy 1, I said 2 Timothy 2, I kept looking at going, that shouldn't be a 1, it should be a 2, no, it's, it should be a 1, 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 11, and I don't believe that this is specifically the gospel that we know, he says, "For I was appointed as a herald and an apostle, and a teacher," this is 1:11, "for which cause also I suffer these things, but I am not ashamed, for I know in whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able to guard the thing entrusted," and I don't think it's to guard the thing entrusted to Paul, this is the thing Paul's entrusted to him, which I would understand to be Paul's eternal secure salvation, and that's going to be very big for this second issue, for that day. Think of how many believers out there, we're going to save most of this for next week. Think of how many believers out there have no sense of security in their salvation because they sit under just really horrible teaching. They may not even have pastors that teach them they can lose their salvation. But they don't have pastors that really enforce well the message of grace. And so sometimes when things happen in their life, they wonder. They are addled by their circumstances. And Paul says, verse 13, going on from there, he says, you have that. You have this. It's an imperative verb. You need to have this. This pattern of healthy words, which you have heard from me in faith and in love in Christ Jesus. And so he says, now you guard the good deposit through the Holy Spirit that is indwelling in us. He says, you have the ability to guard. Now you're not guarding what God's guarding. What you're guarding is now the truth that has been committed to you. The truth that assures believers of this. The truth that teaches believers about the grace of God and what God does. And essentially, the issue Paul, interestingly enough, that Paul's going to deal with here in 2 Timothy, in the middle here, the second issue that we'll come back to, really is, it's an issue of living by grace, but it really involves an idea of eternal security. Eternal security is the logical conclusion of understanding grace living. Really is the logical conclusion. The last one he has to deal with, that he really addresses in chapter 4, we'll point this one out here. You can look ahead at these, and you can be thinking about these for when we come back and address them. But you have this great message, and why is it that you don't see people tripping over themselves to get to this teaching? I mean, do you ever wonder that? When we talk about grace and teach people how to have victory over the sin nature and victory over Satan, why is not this auditorium at our church packed out? Why don't we have to have 3 services every week for people packed out to do that? Because he says here in 2 Timothy chapter 4, he says in verse 2, you herald with authority the word. You have to be ready when it is seasonable and when it is not seasonable. Now, what does he mean by not seasonable? There's a number of things in between, but go down to verse 3. For a time will come when they will not put up with healthy doctrine that is not for your practice. In other words, shall we say, they won't put up with a healthy teaching of the Old Testament. If you don't teach them how to be a Daniel and a David, and a David that slays giants, if you don't teach them how to do those things, they're going to walk, because that's what they want to hear. They don't want to hear doctrine that they have to think about. They want to go home thinking, yeah, I can slay my giants this week in my life. Pastor Tim gave us a rousing, slain giants message. That's what they want. And he says, they will not, he says, put up with that, but according to their lusts, they will heap up in piles teachers that are involved in tickling their ears. That means that there's an abundance of teachers that will tell them what they want to hear. There's a bunch of teachers that will misapply, misteach truth, he says, because they will heap them up in piles. That's a big issue. And that, by the way, from what Paul is saying, is indicative of the fact this is where most of real Christianity, we're not talking about unsaved people now. Oh, true, unsaved people, I don't expect anything better out of them. But these are real Christians going to real churches with real believing pastors, and he says there are so many of them that will not put up with it that they can pile up the pastors in heaps. Or the teachers, I should say. So that's the third issue that he's going to deal with, that he's going to have to address a little bit, and it all fits into this. So now let's go back and let's look at the first issue tonight very quickly. We already looked at this on Sunday, so if you paid attention on Sunday, this is familiar. 2 Timothy chapter 1. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 3, Paul says that he says, having then grace by God, to whom I serve then from my forefathers in a clean conscience unceasingly, he says, I'm having you or remembering you in my prayers night and day, longing to see you, remembering with tears and with joy. So Paul thinks back to Timothy and he's thinking, man, I have just positive remembrance of you. Remember Timothy, when Paul comes back after going down to Jerusalem in Acts 15 to settle that issue, And he comes back. He returns to one of those cities, the city of Derbe, that he had visited on his first missionary journey. And in between that time that he'd been gone, there's a disciple there by the name of Timothy that has distinguished himself among the believers. Confident, he probably was saved on the first visit. Paul comes back maybe a year later, and in that year, Timothy has really grown, so much so that Paul takes him along. And if people think that Timothy just gets saved in Acts 16 and Paul takes him along as a brand new novice, the problem with that is that when Paul makes that loop up through Thessalonica and Berea and then ends up down in Athens, he sends Timothy back to take care of things that are left undone in Thessalonica. You don't do that with a novice. You don't take a wet behind their ears brand new believer and say, hey, go back and take care of those problems. You take somebody that you know is grown, has matured, and can be trusted. And that's what he does. Apparently does something similar with Luke, too, because Luke disappears after Philippi. So apparently he leaves Luke behind in Philippi, but we don't know that for certain. But he says then, in verse, as we were looking at this on Sunday, verse 5, he says, and I am reminded of this, of your sincere faith, a faith that was first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and now I am sure is in you. So his grandmother and his mother, as we said on Sunday, were believers. There's no evidence that his father was. His father was a Greek, which that doesn't mean he couldn't have been a believer, but he's never addressed other than that fact. Verse 6, he says, for which cause, and I remind you to stir up the flame then of your grace gift, which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For, he says, God has not given us a spirit of cowardice, but of power and of love and of a saved frame of mind or a saved attitude. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony of the Lord, nor of me, his prisoner, but suffer together with me in the gospel. So what Paul's telling Timothy here, Timothy is, there's two possibilities with Timothy, because he's going to tell him at the end of this letter in 2 Timothy chapter 4, I'll see if I can find the verse for you just really quick. Yeah, verse 5, if you want to mark it down, he tells him to do the work of an evangelist. And because these are called, what are 1 Timothy, Titus, 1, 2 Timothy and Titus called generally by Christians? What do they call these three letters? No, but it's the pastoral epistles. So they're letters about, what do we mean? What do we usually mean by that?
Qualifications for pastors.
About pastors. Yeah, they think these are pastors. So everybody comes to chapter 4 and they go, well, this is to pastors. And Timothy is a pastor. And therefore, as a pastor, he's supposed to work an evangelist. So a pastor is supposed to be an evangelist. But there's actually two better understandings of this. When Paul gives the qualifications for a bishop in 1 Timothy, it's because Timothy is to be finding men qualified to fill those positions. That's what he's supposed to be doing. That's why he has the list of qualifications. It's not because he himself has to know, oh, am I qualified? No, it's for how he finds men that are qualified, just like Titus is also doing that same job. Timothy, there's two possibilities with Timothy. When do you get your spiritual gift? Yeah, the very moment you believe. But Paul says, when did Timothy get his gift? Yeah, it says right there in verse 6. He says, you got yours through the laying out of my hands. Now that means one of two things. One, that Timothy had two gifts, which is unusual. He had a gift when he got saved, and then Paul laid hands on him and bequeathed or gave to him or was involved in God giving him a second gift. That's a possibility. Okay. The other possibility is that he didn't get his gift immediately at salvation. And for whatever reason, he gets his gift through Paul. Now, that does happen in the book of Acts. There are occasions in the book of Acts where the apostles come and lay hands on people, and they receive the Spirit, and that's when they're receiving the Spirit, that's also when they would be receiving the gift. It doesn't do you any good to get a gift if you don't have the Spirit, because it's a gift that pertains to the Spirit. Something that the Spirit makes possible worked out in you. And that, so there's a possibility that maybe because of the nature of what Timothy was doing, what he was going to do, what God had planned for him, that he wanted Paul to lay his hands and be involved in giving that gift. Because the other evidence is that Timothy also is an apostle. And we know that from 1 Thessalonians, that Paul looks at himself, Timothy, and Silvanus as apostles. He refers to all three of them as apostles. And some people go, well, there's only 12 apostles. Chapter and verse, it says there's only 12 apostles. See, because apostle is a gift. What we often are doing is we're confusing the men that were the original 12 disciples that became apostles with the gift of apostle. You go to the book of Romans. Flip with me over to Romans 16 for a moment. Romans chapter 16, Paul has this wonderful list of people that are in the church in Rome, and that he gives all these personal greetings. Wouldn't this be great if you get this letter, the church at Rome, and all of a sudden Paul comes along and greet Gary and Leslie and the church that meets at their house. You'd go, oh, Paul remembered us. That would be exciting, right? For somebody to actually remember you. Well, so Paul goes through and he does a number of these things. And in verse 7, he says, you greet Andronicus and Junius, my kinsmen. Now that either means that they're relatives of Paul or they're fellow Jews, and my fellow prisoners, meaning that Paul has been imprisoned and these men had actually done some prison time, apparently as believers, likewise, who are notable or those who are outstanding among the apostles. Now, some people take this just meaning all the apostles know these two guys. But it's better to understand that these two guys are men that have the gift of apostle, and they really stand out in their exercise of their gift as an apostle. And there is, it seems like there's one more here that I was looking for. I'm not seeing it. Seen the second one here that I was looking for. I missed it. Anyway, but that's okay. But here we have at least two men that he treats as, in this regard, as being apostles in here. He looks at them that way. Boy, it's still driving me nuts. I thought it was right there. Anyway, but he mentions Titus as being apostle. Silas. Silas is known as he's known in Acts 15 as a prophet, but he's also known as an apostle. So let's go back over to 2 Timothy, and we're thinking about this, just trying to talk about this gift that he has by laying on of hands. Even if this is referring to his apostolic gift, did Paul, as an apostle, do a lot of evangelism? Did he do probably more evangelism than the average Christian? Yeah. Whether he did as much as an evangelist would, I don't know. But he did do a lot of evangelism. In fact, when he moved into a city, that was kind of how he started. Did a lot of evangelism. And then from there goes on and he teaches and does a number of other things. I always look at the apostles. They almost seem like they're kind of like a Renaissance man. If you remember what the Renaissance men were, they were men that studied math and science and architecture and painting and sculpture and all this stuff. They just tried to know a little bit of everything. Okay. And the apostles seemed to be like that. They kind of were like all the gifts wrapped up in one man so that you had these men that could go around and start churches. That's a tough thing, really, for when you send out a missionary across the seas, that's one of the tough things. Josh will tell you that. He's like, there's things he can see that he can do, but there's things that not he's worried about when they reach that point because that's not one of his strong suits. Because today, you have one gift. And can you do things other than your gift? Yeah, sure. But you may not be as good at them in those things. And when we talk about missionaries, the problem is the word missionary is simply a Latin translation of the word apostle. So you're really calling, every time you call a missionary, you say, we're sending out apostles. But we don't have any apostles anymore. They're gone. They were there for a generation. And when that generation passed, it was over. When that generation ended, with the New Testament being completed, no more apostles. Okay. Timothy, I think, has the gift of apostle. I think that's the real issue. And one of the things he's not doing as that apostle is he's no longer doing his activity as an evangelist. He's in danger, as we looked at on Sunday. If you remember this, look at it in there in verse 8, he's in danger of being ashamed. Doesn't say stop being ashamed. It says do not become ashamed. Uses a subjunctive case of this. Don't become. Don't let it come to be that you are ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me as prisoner. Paul has apparently gotten word about Timothy, that Timothy's in danger of becoming ashamed of these. Now, ashamed of them doesn't necessarily mean like, oh, that's just, I'm so embarrassed by that. I don't think that's not always what their word shame meant. Sometimes their shame is that a thing so bothers you, you're so afraid of what might happen to you because of it, that you back away. Because in reality, the word shame in the Greek is built off the word strength, ischuos, which is strength that is innate. What?
Shame, you said?
It's built off that. But then it has, here's a fun word, you can all expression, alpha perivative. Okay? Huh. It's simply, it's an A, like the letter A, you put in front of a word to say no strength. So shame, their idea of shame, was built, and it's upon, and then you have an epipreposition in front of that, which means upon no strength. So shame was like, well, you see something, makes you weak in the knees. You're kind of like, ah, and upon that, you do what? You don't act. You hide. You draw back. Hide behind the crowd. Hopefully they don't see me. That kind of thing. This is what's happening to Timothy. He is in danger of being so intimidated from that word in verse 7, cowardice, so intimidated by the antagonism of people against the gospel of Jesus Christ. Another good demonstration that the apostles were not turning the Roman world up. I just came across somebody the other day said that. How could these guys have turned the Roman world upside? They didn't turn the Roman world upside down. The only time you have that stated in the book of Acts is it's stated by two accusers of Paul trying to cause problems for Paul. And they actually were the ones that were causing the problem. Paul hadn't done anything, but they didn't like him. And so they stirred up a problem and then blamed it on Paul, saying, this is what he's doing. And so he says, Timothy, you're in danger of being ashamed. Okay. So what's Timothy not doing then? Question number one, what's he not doing? He's not doing the work of an evangelist, which he says at the end of the letter. We saw that, 4:5, or at least I referenced it. He's not doing the work of an evangelist. He's holding his tongue. Why, according to verse 7? What does it say in verse 7 he's struggling with?
Fear.
Fear, yeah. This word, our Bibles translate it, timidity or cowardice. It's just a different variety of the word fear. It is a fear. It just isn't the phobos fear, but it is fear nonetheless. And it's causing him then to not do what he's supposed to do. And so Paul tells him, I always think this is very interesting in verse 8, the invitation is, don't be ashamed of the gospel, don't be ashamed of me, but suffer together. He doesn't say, just start doing it, everything will be okay, Timothy. He doesn't say that. He says, suffer with me. He says, suffer with me. Just go ahead and suffer. There's one last thing that, we talked about this on Sunday, but in Hebrews 13:23, we found that Timothy had been in prison. So Timothy also knew what it was like to be in prison. And I wouldn't want to be in prison today, no matter what our prisons might be like. But their prisons back then, I mean, you basically were down. I mean, they didn't have candles, they didn't have lights, and they certainly, of course, they didn't have television at all, but they didn't have any amenities. Those guys got fed whatever was left over from the jailer on a daily basis, and given water, and they were kept locked down in dark rooms with no light. That was imprisonment to them. So you imagine sitting on cold stone, locked down there, not being able to see any sunlight, not even a candlelight, nothing to read. You're just locked down in there. And Timothy had an experience in imprisonment apparently like that, and he'd been set free. So Timothy knew what that was like to spend some time in prison. We don't know how long he was there.
Which might have something to do with how come he was scared.
Exactly, yeah, because he doesn't want to go through that again. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of us could. I mean, seriously, we all stand here and we probably read these things and go, I'd stand strong for God. That would be me. I always think that, boy, it's been over 20 years now, right? The Columbine shooting down there. And remember the one girl that they asked, are you a Christian? And she said, yes, not ashamed. And they shot and killed her. And so you got a lot of, you know, you talk to young people. Would you ever do that? And young people, oh, I would stand strong. But you know what? The thing is, none of us know until a person holds a gun to our head what we're going to do. Are we going to chicken out or are we going to stand strong? We'd all like to say we'd stand strong, but none of us have faced that situation. I don't know. Has any of you faced that type of situation yet?
Mm-hmm. I just watched a movie on that girl.
Mm-hmm. And she was fraught with not standing strong. And then that day came, and she did.
Yeah. I would always like to think that I would stand strong. But Timothy, who had really served and Paul really trusted him. So we're not talking about, he's not just this any Yahoo out there. Okay, that was my dad's word growing up, a Yahoo. It's not just anybody. This is a guy Paul really had trusted with a lot of work. If this could happen to him, it's a good warning call for us that we all potentially could be susceptible to this if Satan might tempt us. And I think Jim was saying that. Right? Yeah, and we talked about that on Sunday. Satanic attack of fear. But we know how to address that. Timothy knows how to address that. In fact, we'll end here with this statement. Look in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. What does he tell Timothy to do in verse 1?
Be strong in the grace of Christ.
Okay. What is that a counterpart to? Ephesians 6:10, which says, be made strong in the Lord. And he uses the same word here for the empowerment, be made strong. Here he adds another element to it that he doesn't say in Ephesians, because remember, a few years have passed. He says, be made strong by the grace that is in Christ Jesus. In other words, you look at Timothy at this point in time, when his knees are knocking together, and he's like, I don't know if I can do this. And God in his grace doesn't go, well, get your act together, Timothy. I'm not going to give you power, you little wimp. He doesn't do that. It's by his grace that he empowers. And he gives it the power in Christ Jesus. And Timothy needs that power. Now, he doesn't tell him necessarily to go on and put on the armor of God, but I think Timothy knows that. Because he says in verse 3 that Timothy is, well, he indicates it. You're to suffer as a good soldier. When do you as a believer soldier? When do you soldier?
Put on the armor.
Yeah. When you put on the armor. It's the only time. The Bible never tells you that you soldier other times. You don't soldier against the flesh. You don't soldier against the world. You only soldier when Satan attacks. It's the only indication in Scripture of when you act as a soldier. And the very fact that he says, suffer your part as a good soldier, is indicating that's what Timothy's facing. It's a satanic attack. Further bears that out. And he needs that strength to do it. Why doesn't Paul go through the armor of God? Why doesn't Paul go through the armor of God with Timothy here? Because he should already know it. I mean, this Timothy probably taught on the armor of God. Maybe more so, probably taught it 100 times. I bet I've taught on the armor of God 100 times in all the different situations, whether it's sitting in the living room with one other person, walking them through it, or walking through somebody on the phone. I can't tell you how many times. I bet somebody called, and we walked through the armor of God. You know, I could pick on you guys. I remember Ben went through a real hard thing that happened at school to him. I don't remember how many years ago that was. And I remember they came in to clean, and he sat down on the front pew, and we started talking, and he and I walked through the armor of God on a Saturday night while they were cleaning. I remember doing that. And I've done that with others of you. Remember doing that with Dan out at your place. Lots of people. And people have done that with me. See? So some of you know what that's like. But that's when you soldier. Is when you're doing that. And he says furthermore in verse 4, when you soldier, Timothy, what do you not do? You don't entangle yourself in everyday affairs, which tells you when you put on the armor of God, what do you have to do for a moment? Okay. You have to focus. You got to stay. In other words, if if you're trying, if you've got, you know, this I would say this is the one place really in the Christian life where you need to be able to kind of step aside for a minute. If you're, I'll pick on Ben because I was trying to think of a good scenario. But if you're Ben and he really needs to put on the armor of God, if he's got 40 junior high students in that gymnasium at one time, you're trying to all corral and keep something going. That's really hard to focus on walking through the armor of God and be doing that at the same time. Paul's saying, this is so serious. Dealing with Satan is so serious. You need Timothy to step back and put on that armor. If it takes you 15 minutes, it's 15 minutes. Peg will testify that I had a situation, I couldn't tell you how long ago, but back a few months ago, that I really had gone through a satanic attack on a Thursday, and we were heading down to Bible study, and I'm driving, and we kind of were driving away, and she was talking to me, and I said, "Hun," I said, "I don't want to be rude, but I just need a quiet for a minute, because I've got something I got." And when I got done, I told her, I said, I was putting on the armor of God. I mean, I had to do it. I did that, I don't know, 15 minutes or so riding in the car. She was really nice about it, you know. But the thing is I had to focus on that because I was struggling so with that. And I didn't want to get down to wherever we were having Bible study that night and still have my head not in the game, you know. And I'd done that earlier in the day, but on the trip down there, we hadn't hardly got out of town and boom, that attack came again. And I kind of remember what it was about, but that's neither here nor there at the moment. But you step back. So Timothy's problem is, let's go and review, his problem is he's afraid. So as a result of his fear, he's doing what?
He's pulling back.
He's not using his gift. And so his gift has to be evangelism. There's all different kinds of different ways. We all have different gifts, and all those could be affected by that fear factor. Okay. What does he need to do to respond? Needs to be strong in the Lord, and then put on the armor, even though Paul doesn't indicate it, but we already said why, okay? And one of the things involved in putting on the armor that I think is important here is that a person sometimes really needs to step back, yeah. Isn't it better to step back and put on the armor of God, really make sure you've thought your way through it, than trying to do it on the fly and you keep getting interrupted by other people coming and you're going, okay, where was I in the armor of God? Now you have to go back. I've tried that. It doesn't work. I can't make it work. Maybe you got a stronger mind than I do. But Paul says, you don't involve yourself in the civilian affairs. Okay. He also kind of compares it to a wrestling match, interestingly enough, which is exactly what he says it is with Satan over in Ephesians 6. He also compares it to a wrestling match with spirit means, not with flesh and blood. And he says you only get the crown, implying that you have.
Where are you at now?
This is in verse 5 of chapter 2. You only get the crown. Well, if you're in a wrestling match, when would you get the crown? At the end. If you did what? If you won. And he says this person can only win if he competes according to the rules. Yeah, there are rules for how it's done. Okay. Are there things you can't do when you wrestle? Yeah, see, Clinton knows that. There's things he cannot do. And if what happens to you, if you pull one of those moves that you're not supposed to do?
Penalty.
You get a penalty, see. And so he says there's a right way to do this. There's a right way to do these things. And likewise, when you've labored in this, hey, you get to partake of things. There's a fruit that the farmer gets to partake of when he's labored. And you get to, and seriously, I don't think there's a time ever that I put on the armor of God that when you're done, you're going, okay, let's get back into life. It's like, there's like a moment where you're just breathing going, oh, just that pressure of being able to breathe. It's like this load is gone and you're just like, wow. That, to me, that's like experiencing the fruit of labor. That's a good thing. Any questions or comments? Yes, Jim.
In dealing with the issue of satanic attack, one of the things that I've wondered several times, it's crossed my mind, is to what would I do if I get faced with satanic attack in the middle of teaching a message, for instance. You're in front of everybody. You can't just stop. And that answer was answered for me with a guest speaker that came here ago that I'm convinced in retrospect was under satanic attack, and he stumbled through his whole lesson. He actually verbalized a couple of times through his message that he had some unreasonable fear, and he was just terrified for some reason. He's spoken many times before. In retrospect, he taught me what you need to do. You need to just stop and step back, and if you need to have somebody else come up and lead the song or something, or just step in, or just have a few moments where he allowed himself to be entangled with the affairs of his life. He had a job to do, and he didn't want to step back from teaching. And that's exactly what you've got to do. If you're in front of a group of people teaching, if you're in front of a class teaching or something, you've got to step back, and you've got to take the time to do it, or you're going to fall flat on your face and make things worse.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a good lesson to me. I felt bad for him, in seeing his struggle, but it taught me a really valuable lesson. It doesn't matter what you're doing. I mean, unless someone's going to die as a result, you need to step back, whatever you're doing, and take a few moments to put on the armor.
Right.
Get yourself right.
Yeah. I could say I can think of one time. I can't think of a time that this happened during the middle of a message, but I can know one that happened like just, I was just about ready to get started, and I started getting up there, and I was like, I can't do this. And I don't remember who I asked, but I said, could you sing a couple of songs? I got to go. Everybody might have thought I had to go to the bathroom or something, but I had to go down the stairs. I just had to kind of walk away for a little bit and sit down and walk and put through the armor of God, because I thought, this is not going to happen. This is just going to be, I'm going to. But that's been a lot of years that I can think back. So, anyway. So
Satan
I
does not always attack us when it's convenient for us to put the armor on.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Any other comments? That's good, though. Thank you. And I think every one of us, like I said, hopefully as we were looking at on Sunday with the armor of God, every one of us can benefit, I think. Even if we don't have the gift of evangelism, we can benefit from. I've had times that I'm supposed to teach something, and somebody comes into church, and I'm like, man, this is going to be real. They're going to really think I am intentionally stepping on their toes. And I'm like, you know what? This is what God has for us. And that time I didn't have to put on the armor, because it's like the temptation came and it was like about that long. And I'm like, nope, that is not the way to respond. This is what we're going to do. And you stuck with it. Okay. But that's not saying that couldn't happen. You know, they go, I don't want to offend these people. I'm going to drive them off. They'll never be back. That's run through my mind more than once with certain things that we're teaching on. So. You have the gift of mercy? I don't know. I'm sure even a person with the gift of mercy has settings where situations in which they might wonder about that. So.